This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community. Welcome to this Joy 94.9 podcast.
We want to hear from you.
It's time for our listener survey. So head to the Joy website and let us know what you love about the station and your presenters.
Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts on Joy's program production team, the volunteers behind Joy podcasts.
The results of this survey will assist us in continuing to be the best possible station we can be.
Head to joy.org.au and have your say. Joy 94.9, your voice, your radio station.
Good evening, I'm David Gale and welcome to The Informer. Tonight I'm joined by Paul McClure. On tonight's Informer, we'll be chatting with the President-elect of the Law Institute of Victoria, Belinda Wilson, about the letter that they have sent to the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. And if you've volunteered for an HIV or AIDS organisation during the 80s or 90s, Shirlene Robinson would love to hear from you. Stay tuned to find out why.
President of the Law Institute of Victoria, Stephen Sapuntsis, has weighed into the debate on whether Australia needs a plebiscite on marriage equality. On the 13th of September, on behalf of the LIV, Mr. Sapuntsis wrote to the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, urging him to do away with the plebiscite and to instead introduce legislation to amend the Commonwealth Marriage Act to allow for marriage between same-sex couples. Tonight on The Informer, we're joined by Belinda Wilson, who is the President-elect of the Law Institute of Victoria, to talk about why the Law Institute felt the need to address the Prime Minister on this issue. But before we move to talking to Belinda, I'll just give her a little bit of a CV. Belinda's held a number of interesting positions over the years, including the President of the Gippsland Law Association. She's been a lecturer at the University of Ballarat, board member at Gipps TAFE. She's been a lawyer working in commercial law with Tyler Tipping and Woods, and she's currently the CEO and corporate counsel for Port Phillip Bay Scallops. Welcome, Belinda.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks, David, for having me today. It's an honour to be here.
Welcome to The Informer.
Thank you.
So, as I said in the intro, the Law Institute has written to the Prime Minister about this, the issue of a plebiscite on same-sex marriage. Can you tell us what prompted the Law Institute to do that?
Yeah, look, the Law Institute has always been quite vocal in this space. We've always supported marriage equality. And I have to say, the Prime Minister here is dealing with a same-sex plebiscite, not marriage equality.
Yes.
And we've seen the recent developments, quite a rushed approach by Malcolm Turnbull, and given that this is such a fundamental human right issue, the Law Institute saw no option but to actually weigh into that debate and go straight to the top, address the Prime Minister about what we think should be done.
Yeah, and the concerns that the Law Institute has about going forward with a plebiscite.
Yeah, look, there's quite a few concerns that we have. I mean, first of all, it's the spending, and we can come back to the inefficiency there, I suppose.
Yeah.
This plebiscite is actually giving weight to a social matter. It's a risky social impact, or potential social impact that it might have. We haven't seen any proposed amendments to the Marriage Act, so we don't actually know what we're voting on. And from a legal point of view, this approach is unnecessary.
Yeah. What?
It's actually quite interesting, because the Law Institute of Victoria doesn't normally sort of do commentary on politics at all. So it's quite an interesting feel that, you know, you've felt it deep enough to send a letter to the Prime Minister, who's also a lawyer as well in training. What moved the Law Institute of Victoria to this step?
David, I mean, as lawyers, we're always practicing. Inside joke there. so we've all got a lot to learn still. But you're right, the Law Institute usually doesn't address political matters, but we felt that this is also a substantial legal matter.
Yeah.
And essentially, when we're dealing with such an important topic, that there are other legal avenues that can easily resolve this matter why does it need to go to a plebiscite?
Well, we keep asking that as a community as well. But as I say, you know, it's not every day that the Law Institute sends a letter to the Prime Minister. I notice one of the first things that you talk about is that equality before the law is not dependent upon public opinion.
Correct. Correct. And unfortunately, if this plebiscite does go through, I mean, this is going to be a really expensive opinion poll, isn't it?
Mm. But getting back to that first point David just raised, equality before the law, there was a 2013 case in the High Court where the highest court in our country, confirmed that federal parliament has the power to change under the Constitution the term marriage. There's a simple fix right there, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that's the easiest solution there. We do have a High Court ruling that says that our Parliament can pass a bill that changes the Marriage Act. And that's the position that the Law Institute does support. Mm. I think from memory, John Howard actually changed the Marriage Act back in 2004.
Yes.
I think the Prime Minister, John Howard, said that the Marriage Act should only be changed by an Act of Parliament.
Exactly. Mm. He specifically went on to say that it shouldn't be changed by courts. And here we're now in a situation in, 2016, where this is going out to public opinion.
Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't, especially if we could, let's go back to the money issue. Mm. What's proposed is a huge amount coming out of the public purse.
Yeah.
And we're in a time where we're talking about budget cuts, tightening the belt. Also, too, I mean, there's so much funding that has been taken out of various areas. When we look at the legal sector, Victoria Legal Aid is struggling demand.
Yeah.
And this money that's proposed on the plebiscite, I mean, even if a small portion of that went into providing access to justice, geez, that would be
a
sight to see. That would be great.
Yeah.
I noticed also in the costing, in the letter that was sent to the Prime Minister, that you don't say that the plebiscite's going to cost $160 million plus the yes and no campaigns. You actually estimate it as much higher. Why is that?
Yeah, look, it's... You're going to have... I suppose at the moment it's costing the government a lot in legal bills.
Yeah.
The government, state and federal, are probably the biggest purchasers of legal services. And I dare say that at the moment they're seeking a lot of external advice on this.
Mm.
But, I mean, you've got the financial costs, but then you've got the human costs.
Well,
and
that's
I think
right.
that's... You can't... give a price to that, and that's where there is great concern.
Well, I know that in the letter, just to break it down, you estimate PricewaterhouseCooper $525 million, and that includes a $66 million cost to the community for funding the campaign, $280 million in lost productivity, and $20 million for the impact on the mental health and well-being of the LGBTI community.
Correct.
It's a huge cost.
Oh.
As you say, there can be money better spent elsewhere, especially when the government is crying out, you know, we need to tighten the purse strings, but they're willing to spend all this money.
Exactly. You've got areas that desperately need funding. You've got domestic violence, which is ongoing. You've got family law matters that Legal Aid cannot fund how they once did. So it's questioning why do we need this plebiscite when there's so many areas that could be focused on instead.
And along with the cost, the financial cost, there's also the social cost, I suppose, and that again gets brought up by the plebiscite causing social division, causing vilification, discrimination against LGBTI people, and that's touched on in the Law Institute's letter, and it refers to a situation in Ireland when they were working through same-sex marriage, and it's just, I don't think it's a cost that we need to bear.
No, definitely not. And I mean, also too, this is setting legal precedent.
Mm.
Now, I cannot recall a plebiscite. I think you've done the figures. When was the last plebiscite?
Yeah, it was something like 100 years ago. 100 years ago. To be honest with you, I had to look it up.
Yeah.
I'd never heard it before.
Yeah.
to find out what it actually means. This is,
I know. And look, if this goes through, I mean, what other plebiscites are we going to have in the future? This is setting.
Sure. It could be up to the Prime Minister, it could be up to the party, it could be up to the right of the Liberal Party as well. Look, I mean, I was watching Fiona Nash last night on Q&A, and I don't think there were very many people that missed that. Talking to Madge Sabansky, and, you know, in the end, she looked like a bit of a dill, because trying to defend this is
trying to toe the party line,
Have you, by any chance, received a response yet from the Prime Minister?
Last time I checked, before I turned my phone off walking in here, I had not received a response from our Prime Minister.
Would it be unusual for him to respond?
Oh, look, it was sent only a few days ago, so let's wait and see.
Wait and see. Hopefully we do get something back. I know that there's a lot of talk about Labor opposing the plebiscite bill. Do you have any? Does the Law Institute have any position in relation to that?
No, look, we don't have a stand on that. Yeah. But really, I mean, what the Law Institute are wanting to see is that this matter proceeds the way it should, which is by a bill introduced in Parliament that changes the Marriage Act, not a bill talking about a plebiscite.
Yeah, the simple and direct approach.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us, Belinda Wilson, President-elect of the Law Institute of Victoria.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did you volunteer for an HIV/AIDS organisation in Australia during the 1980s or 90s? Historians at the Macquarie University and the University of Adelaide wish to interview individuals who volunteered in HIV/AIDS related capacities in the 80s and early 90s as part of a new nationwide project. Volunteers played a critical part in Australia's response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, but their contribution is yet to be fully acknowledged. This project is interested in the roles they played, the impact of their involvement on both individuals and HIV/AIDS organisations, and the place of those volunteers in Australian history. Tonight on The Informer, we're joined by Dr. Shirlene Robinson from Macquarie University in Sydney. Hello, Shirlene. Welcome, Dr. Robinson.
Hi, David. Nice to be chatting with you.
Look, it's great to have you on The Informer. Can you tell us, what is this project about?
Well, as a lot of people might realise, Australia's response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic was really, I think, one of the best in the Western world. And, you know, sometimes people think about what happened in America, where Ronald Reagan didn't mention AIDS until it had killed more people than the Vietnam War, and, you know, Margaret Thatcher's Britain, where the response also was quite slow. But Australia's response was really good in terms of working with affected communities. And I think that one of the really key elements to Australia's response was the role that volunteers played. And what we're trying to do with this project, I guess, is to have a little bit of a closer look at what those volunteers experienced and to recognise their contribution.
So what made you decide to look at this? I mean, I remember the time myself because, as you say, you know, a lot of people were motivated as volunteers. So what made you decide to look at this from a historic perspective?
Yeah, I think it was just that I think it's a really important topic and one that hasn't really received enough acknowledgement in society. And we in Australia, I think we do really respect the role of volunteers. So I think that there's a lot that can be learned by you know, looking at what motivates people and what we can do to better support them as well. And particularly with the HIV/AIDS example, it was such a difficult time for people. I think there are some really useful lessons that we can learn by having a look at what life was like for those volunteers.
Yeah, I think that also was born out of the fact that people's ignorance didn't really allow them to, you know, understand the medical facts at the time. And also, you know, it was developing at the time and, you know, people were only just finding out about the illness, certainly in the early part of the epidemic. And then, of course, it was up to friends and relatives and people to become involved as volunteers.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something really interesting there, just like how little was, I guess, known about HIV and AIDS in the very, you know, when it first came to Australian shores. And that must have been a truly frightening thing for, you know, particularly the gay male community to see, you know, suddenly this impact and not really fully comprehend what was happening or how it could really be contained or what they could do to support people, even when, you know, a lot of people didn't know if they were themselves living with HIV/AIDS. So it must have been a truly difficult time for so many people.
Yeah, look, I can certainly remember the time, but of course, younger people that might hear about this probably wouldn't know about what was going at the time. Maybe they've seen some of the movies like the Dallas Buyers Club, which certainly put a human face on what people were going through. You know, the rest of us saw friends die, relatives die, and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, Australians are great volunteers. I mean, we're all volunteers here at Joy 94.9. But, you know, Australians have always been volunteers. So the volunteers that did this were prepared to step up to something quite unknown. Is that what you're trying to find out about? What motivated people?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, what motivated them and how can we better support people that do perform these really important roles in society? Because, as you say, you know, volunteers really are, I think, the lifeblood of so many parts of Australian society. And, you know, particularly for us in the LGBT community, so many things like, I mean, I'm speaking today, as you mentioned, with volunteers, and so much activism comes from people who are giving up their time. So it's a really important part of Australian society and a really important part, I think, of LGBT history as well. And so I think that these volunteers that were associated with the HIV/AIDS epidemic, they probably haven't really received the recognition that they deserve. And that's also something that really interests me. Why is it that we haven't really looked fully at their contribution and talk? Why don't we talk about that in Australian history as much as we should do, given that it was so significant?
Have you come to any conclusions about that, Shirlene, about why these volunteers weren't so recognised?
I suspect that it could be because a lot of these people were from groups that were marginalised in Australian society and perhaps to some extent still are. So you have, you know, gay men, lesbians, transgender people. You've also got sex workers and injecting drug users who step up to the plate. And it could be that perhaps because of the fact that these were marginalised people, there has been something of a reluctance to fully recognise them as the heroes that I think they really were in this era.
So what sort of work did these volunteering men and women do?
Well, I think that the extent of their contributions is really quite fascinating, and it does show you the skill set that we as a community, and, you know, there were also some straight people, and we're also interested in talking to them as well. But, you know, there are a lot of skills that that people have that they can contribute and did contribute during this time period. So it could be anything from maybe, you know, answering the phone lines at an AIDS council, or it could have been serving on the board, you know, obviously the Victorian AIDS Council, you know, doing the books for people, perhaps compiling magazines. There's also that element of, and really quite intense work of providing support and nursing for people who were living with HIV and AIDS. And often that, you know, that was done by people who themselves were could be very sick or you know, before antiretrovirals. So a really wide range of tasks that people did. And yeah, I mean, I can't really comprehend what that must have been like for people to sort of, you know, be doing those nursing tasks. But it was vital.
Yeah, and probably for people that they knew or were friends with or had some association with to then step in and care for them in that situation must have been heartbreaking and hard work.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, yes, you know, there's stories about people who were caring for partners because they just didn't feel that there were other people that could do it. And certainly for, like, friend networks of friends that would sort of support each other by, you know, going around and sharing shifts of caring for people, particularly in, you know, when the support structures were still developing in the very early years, that sort of work was so important.
Yeah, well, once again, during those early years, you know, people were worried that somebody that was HIV positive or certainly to the extent where they'd contracted AIDS might actually infect their children. I mean, as I say, it was probably a bit of blind ignorance, but at the time, you know, it was definitely a very different sort of time. So these people that did actually step up and volunteer, I expect, do need to be recognised.
Yeah, and I think that it is true that there's the stigma. We sometimes forget what that must have been like, but you know, there was a bit of a journey that Australia had to go on to being more accepting of HIV-positive people. And I think, fortunately, we have learnt a lot and improved a lot as a society, but obviously there's still a way to go. But definitely in those early years, even for, say, you know, there's this older women and people like that who would go and volunteer, and they would sort of have people be suspicious of them or treat them sort of a bit weirdly. Yes, mums. That's one of the really interesting elements of it is, mothers, getting in there and helping, which is really like a quite a heartwarming story, I guess, at a very difficult time.
So you'd like to even hear from mums, from relatives, from friends that did volunteer in different organisations. What sort of stories are actually coming out of the project so far?
Definitely hear from anyone who, whether you be sort of gay or straight or bisexual or injecting drugs, then anyone, heterosexual community, we welcome all people, all applications are welcome. But in terms of the sort of volunteering that people did and the stories that are coming through, it's definitely stories that capture, I think, particularly in the early years, the just how heartbreaking it really was.
Are there any stories you'd like to share?
There's people who talk about having to nurse partners. That's something that a couple of people have discussed. Little support they sort of felt they had from the broader society at times. That's something that people have also mentioned, that, there was that difficulty of trying to care for people and have such intense work happening, and then sort of feeling that you were fighting that alone, and that the rest of society wasn't really with you,
and kind of isolated.
And that's interesting. Mm. Yeah. So that's also interesting too, to think that people sort of doing this alone in a sense in the early years, and also a bit later. So, and then of course people who we've sort of chatted to who themselves were living with HIV, and I guess what that was like, and then perhaps how difficult it has been for some of them to have lived through it, and then have seen revolutions in medicine, but know that other people haven't come through that, and that's quite a sad element of the interviewing process, I think.
We're also lucky to have organisations that have come from all of that particular time. We have the VAC in Melbourne, and we actually had the CEO of the VAC on the show recently when we were talking about the PrEPX trial. Now, I mean, this is how far we've gone. We've gone from ground zero to PrEPX trials being held around the country. And he was talking about how the organisation, the VAC, started, I think it was in the Laird Hotel, which is a gay hotel here in Melbourne, for those that aren't too sure. And, I suppose out of this whole crisis, so many wonderful things have come as well.
Yeah, and I think it's such a history that people can be proud of. And, you talk about the Victorian AIDS Council or in Sydney, ACON or the Queensland AIDS Council. I think it was by about 1985, every state and territory had an AIDS Council, largely driven by volunteers. And so the fact that they've survived largely and have continued to play a really important role is a great thing. And I think it does deserve further scrutiny.
So, of course, if anybody was involved in the early parts of those years with those organisations or thinks that they might be a candidate to be interviewed, they can check out www.hivaidsvolunteers.com.au. Now, we'll put that onto our website after we put our podcast out, which is soon after the show. So they will make sure there's a link there so people can actually get in contact with you and become part of this study, which is a most important study. So if anybody is listening at the moment, please, we implore you to certainly get on board with this, because this is part of our history that really needs to be told. Isn't that right, Sherlene?
Absolutely. And I think it's the most important way of doing that is to talk to the people that were involved and lived through it. So definitely welcome everyone to come and have a look at HIVAIDSvolunteers.com.au.
All right, so we'll put those links up. It's been great talking to you, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us tonight. And we look forward to hearing more about how the study goes and maybe some of the results and some of the that you get from this as well.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Bye.
We'd like to thank tonight's guests on The Informer. We've had Belinda Wilson, the President-elect of the Law Institute of Victoria, and, of course, Dr. Sherlene Robinson of the Macquarie University. We've been talking about just now, and, of course, about the letter from the Law Institute of Victoria to the Prime Minister. For details of the HIV/AIDS volunteer survey, check out the links on our podcast of this show, which will be probably up in about an hour's time. Coming up next is Worldwide Wave, and tonight they'll be travelling to Italy. And, of course, be listening again to The Informer tomorrow night. The Informer will be on with Dean Beck at 6:30 p.m. I'm David Gale.
And I'm Paul McClure. Good night.
Hi, I'm Hannah. Over 1 million children have been harmed by family violence. 1 in 5 women have suffered from domestic violence. And half of those women will be caring for children, like me.
At Berry Street, we know this is all of our problem. Violence is probably happening to someone in our own street. They're our kids. Please Google Hannah at Berry Street and donate today. It's urgent.
For kids like me.
Joy sponsor.
At Rainbow Fertility, we believe everyone deserves to experience the joys of parenthood. We are Australia's first dedicated fertility and IVF provider for the LGBTI community. During our open evening, you can talk one-on-one with our doctors. Whether it's donor insemination, IVF, surrogacy or egg donor programs, whether you're single or in a relationship. Register for the next Rainbow Fertility open evening tomorrow at rainbowfertility.com.au. In Australia, surrogacy and gamete donation must be altruistic.
Joy sponsor.
Melbourne's most uplifting music mix for your weekdays.
Your voice. Your voice. Always. Always. Joy 94.9.
Joy News.
Joy News.
Joy News.
Joy.
15 degrees in Melbourne after a top today of 18. Good evening, Christopher Talbot with your 7 o'clock news on Joy 94.9. Leading the news tonight, and a new report says Australia's 200 biggest companies are on track to have 30% of board positions filled by female directors by the end of 2018, but only if current momentum is maintained. The researchers found monthly new female appointment rates to ASX 200 boards jumped to 42.8% to the year to June 2016, up from 9% in 2009. But there are still 22 boards within the top 200 group with no women directors at the end of August. More than two-thirds of voters polled have rejected spending taxpayers' money on the yes and no campaigns for the same-sex marriage plebiscite. But an essential poll published today has found 68% of voters disapprove of the spending, with only 10% in favour.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.